two young fathers are shot to death outside an iconic Utah restaurant.
I said, your dad has been hurt really bad.
The grief was disorienting for those left behind, until one choice changed everything.
I just remember writing this letter, and it wasn't me writing it.
Can a personal decision shape generations?
We're all falling for this guy's trick.
I'm Amy Donaldson. Season 2 of The Letter, Ripple Effect, is available now. Follow us at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey everyone, are you ready to add a sprinkle of joy to your day? Then you need to check out Add to Cart. Hi, I'm Sujan Pak.
And I'm Kulap Vilaysack. We're your hosts, and on this show, we talk about the things we buy, the things we buy into, and what it says about who we are.
That's right. Each week, we're going to have some honest and maybe, you know, a little TMI conversations about all the fabulous, weird, wonderful things we're adding to or ditching from our carts. You know, we talk about beauty products, latest health trends, philosophies we're passionate about. Nothing is off limits on this podcast.
We're diving deep into everything we and our guests buy into and exploring what it reveals about who we truly are. We're going to decide what's worth the investment, be it money or emotions.
Add to Cart from Lemonada Media has new episodes out on Tuesdays, wherever you get your podcasts.
Lemonada.
Welcome to In the Bubble. This is Andy Slavitt. It's Monday, September 26th, and I want to start by saying, happy birthday, Mom. I know you're listening. I hope you have a great day. And I miss you. Okay, everybody, collectively. Aw, wasn't that nice? Our show today is about democracy in peril. You hear this all the time. You hear this all the time, I bet. People say to you, hey, this democracy is in a really scary place, or you read about it. It's just sort of become a common thing to say. In fact, the majority of Americans, both parties, think that democracy is in trouble. Many maybe for different reasons. I think it is too. I kind of worry about this. This is on my list of things to worry about because I don't think that it fixes itself. I think there are some things that happen and have happened over the last few years that are difficult to recover from. They set precedents. They break barriers. They kind of eat away at our institutions. But I do think there are things we can recover from if we understand them. I know that this show sometimes approaches very anxiety-provoking topics like climate, like the rights that are being taken away by the Supreme Court, like the pandemic. And I know these things bring all of us angst. They bring me angst sometimes. But what I found is a really pretty good start to an anecdote is to understand them, get some experts on this show to talk about them, explain them, and put them in some proper perspective so that we can begin to work on how we solve them, to work on solutions. And at that level, even if we are in a somewhat unprecedented place with our democracy, solving tough problems is not unprecedented. We've always had to do it. We've always had to do it. And we have to do it here now. And I want to make sure that this is clear. In my mind, at least, this is not an episode about Donald Trump's threat to democracy. It's about all of the threats to democracy. And I do think Donald Trump is in that picture somewhere. We got to try to place him. But there are other things, and we know about them. The Electoral College, voting rights, gerrymandering, differences of opinion, how Supreme Court nominees get picked, the power of the Senate versus the power of the House. And there are some genuine differences, by the way, that are not threats to democracy. The power that should be in the federal government versus the power of the states. Those are genuine differences that we've always had in this country that are not threats to democracy, in my view. They are part of the kind of battle framework that's always existed here. It can exist within our democracy. But some of these other things are worth exploring. And my guest today is David Leonhardt from the New York Times. David wrote an incredible piece of work that he had researched for a long time to lay out the threats to democracy. And I'm going to ask him to do that here on this show. Now, you may know the name David Leonhardt from a lot of different places. He writes a newsletter for the New York Times called Morning. It is, I think, the most widely read newsletter to go into people's email boxes. And some of you may recall some of the things he's written about the pandemic. And I suspect that some of you disagree with some of what he's had to say. And I will tell you that I don't agree with everything that David Leonhardt has written. I think some of that has been well-informed. Some of it has been thought-provoking. Some of it has been slightly misinformed. And I have told him that when I see things that he writes that I don't think are correct, I send him notes. So the question is, if you really don't like David Leonhardt because of a couple columns he's written, that's certainly okay. It's certainly your right. And if you'd say, you know what, that makes me not want to listen to him, I would challenge that. I would challenge that. And I would say, first of all, we have to listen civilly to people we disagree with. And if we can't listen to a very smart, thoughtful reporter, writer, how are we going to listen to people with very divergent views than ours? And I think it's important that we try to make that effort. I also think you'll find that, particularly on this topic of democracy, he's incredibly thoughtful, incredibly straightforward, very clear. And I think this is a great episode. I think this dispels some myths about what we should be worried about and focus us in on some of the things that are happening in this country that we have to pay attention to if we value our form of government lasting. There are warning signs. And this conversation does a better job pointing out these warning signs, or a clearer job pointing out these warning signs, than I could have hoped for. So I'm very excited to bring it to you. Let's bring in David Leonhardt. It's a pleasure to have you in the bubble, David.
Thanks, Andy. It's great to be here. I'm a longtime listener.
Well, I'm a longtime reader. And maybe we'll get into a little bit of that later. But I think the focus of our conversation, which I think will be interesting, is some work you've done and something you've written about, which is this conversation we hear more and more frequently, which is that our democracy is in danger.
Yes.
And it's interesting because I think this is the one conversation that if you're sitting in the Democrat bubble and you're sitting in the Republican bubble, seems to be a constant thread. Some majority, something like 60% of Democrats and Republicans, say that the democracy is in danger. So is it?
I think it is. And I say that as someone who is sort of an inherent optimist. I don't tend toward apocalyptic warnings about the state of our politics. I've actually, over the decades, had a lot of debates with people I know and love, in which I feel like I've been on the end of the kind of life tends to get better in the United States, not naturally, because people fight for it. That's sort of a view that you, for example, often hear former President Obama express, and I think it's more right than wrong. And yet, I now see our country facing a set of risks and problems, some of which I never really expected to see in my lifetime. I didn't expect in my lifetime to not be sure that the losing candidate in a presidential election would accept the result, and indeed not be sure if that candidate tried to overturn it, that he or she would fail. I think it's possible that over the next decade, we could have yet another attempt by a losing presidential candidate, or maybe a Senate candidate in an important race. I guess all the Senate races are important, to attempt to overturn the result. And I don't feel completely confident that that effort would fail. And that's incredibly alarming. I mean, if that were to happen in a presidential election, it would represent a fundamental breakdown in our democracy. democracy, a problem we've never had before. We can talk about other problems we've had.
Sure.
And then on top of that, there are all of these also kind of slow building long-term problems that I'll leave aside for later in our conversation. But some of those are new and unprecedented as well. At the New York Times, we basically need special dispensation to use the word unprecedented because it's overused. And yet there are a few ways in which these things really are unprecedented.
I do want to get into those too, because people have been worried about the democracy since before the sort of big steal, big lie, however you want to look at it. But I want to just stick on this context of unprecedented for a second. I mean, hasn't our democracy always been delicate? And if so, what's different today, and what makes it different?
So our democracy has always been flawed, obviously. And in some major ways, it is far less flawed today than it was at its founding and for a very long time. Basically, the background of the story is that early this year, the editors of the Times asked me to set out to write a piece that would try to encapsulate the threats to our democracy. My assignment was not to make an original argument. It was to really give people an overview of what was going on. And as I reported that, and I talked to political scientists and historians, and I thought about it, and I talked to my colleagues around the world and around the country, one of the things that I think helped me as a frame is there's a question of who counts and who's a citizen. And then there's a question of, does the government reflect the majority will of those citizens? And by the first measure, who counts as a citizen, we are in a better spot, arguably, than we ever have been in American history. At our founding, obviously, Black people could not vote. They were enslaved. Women could not vote. Natives could not vote. So we're really talking about incredible progress on all those fronts. The second question is, does the government represent the majority will of the people who are enfranchised, who are considered citizens? And actually, over the course of our history, the country has done a very good job of meeting that standard. And so if you sort of look back, you don't have a period in which the minority of the enfranchised citizens are dictating government policy. Sure, there are little times where you basically have tied elections. But basically, what you have is the idea that when a party wins, the majority sentiment of the people. So I'm thinking of Thomas Jefferson's Virginians in the early 19th century. I'm thinking of the Republican Party in the late 19th century. I'm thinking of the New Deal Democrats for decades. And I'm thinking of the Reagan Republicans. So basically, those were all coalitions that really attracted majority support and were able to govern over extended periods. Today, we have a party, the Democratic Party. It has won 7 of the last 8 presidential popular votes. 7 of 8. That is unprecedented. You can go back. There are some other parties, like the ones I just mentioned, that sometimes won 6 of 7. No party before has ever won 7 of the past 8 popular votes. And yet, obviously, Democrats are not really able to fully govern. They're occasionally able to sort of govern, like over the past year and a half. That disconnect between the majority will of enfranchised people and government power, it really has no precedent.
And you give an example of the Supreme Court. What's happened with the Supreme Court over the course of 7 people from one party, it happens to be a Democratic Party, winning the presidential election by the popular vote. And you give the example of how the Supreme Court doesn't seem to reflect that.
Correct. So 6 of the 9 appointees on the Supreme Court are Republican appointees. So even if we want to get out of the popular vote, every current Supreme Court justice has been appointed during one of the last 9 presidential terms, going back to Clarence Thomas in George H.W. Bush's term. In those 9 terms, 5 have been served by Democrats and 4 by Republicans. You would think that the Supreme Court should reflect at least that, even if not the popular vote. But instead of having 5 seats on the court of the 9, Democratic appointees have 3. Some of that is coincidence. Democrats have been less smart and less effective at retiring well. The obvious example there is Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She had an opportunity to retire in 2014. Many Democrats urged her to. President Obama was president. Democrats controlled the Senate. Obama had shown that he would appoint progressive justices like Sotomayor and Kagan. And yet Ginsburg decided for personal reasons that she wanted to remain on the court. And obviously that was a decision that worked out very badly for all kinds of things that Democrats care about. But it's mostly not that. It's mostly the fact that a combination of Republicans, despite losing the popular vote, have been able to win the presidency. And then this disconnect between majority will and political outcomes is most pronounced in the Senate. And so every one of President Trump's three Supreme Court justices was confirmed with senators representing a minority of the population. The only reason Mitch McConnell was able to block Obama from replacing Antonin Scalia in President Obama's last year in office was, again, that Republicans had a Senate majority, even though it wasn't, they didn't represent a majority of the population. And so that has really created this incredible disconnect. And then you add to it the fact that the current Supreme Court, at least five of the six Republican appointees and five of the nine justices, are very ambitious and aggressive and willing to overturn laws. And you put that together and you have a Supreme Court that is actually quite far removed on a whole bunch of questions from where majority opinion in this country seems to be.
So you've just hit on, you know, we've got our three branches of government. And what you've just hit on, if I take a tour through the three branches of government, we've got one very powerful branch that at the top of it, at the very least, the Supreme Court, is not reflective of the majority view in the democracy. You've got a second branch, of which we have two branches of that branch, the Senate and the House, and one of which, as you just stated, the minority is underrepresented for reasons that we'll go into, but at the U.S. Senate, and it's the power that's given there. And then the third branch, the executive branch, as we've talked about, the majority of the popular vote doesn't always go to the winner. But as you go through the history, we got there for both probably good and bad reasons, and I'm wondering if you could talk about that a little bit. You know, good reasons being, hey, in a democracy, it's useful to protect the rights of the minority from being overrun by a majority. And we've gotten there for some bad reasons, i.e. trying to disenfranchise humans who were, you know, slaves and women, and just the sheer nature of trying to get colonies to agree to support a federal government. Can you talk about how much of what we're facing is sort of, it's okay because we designed it this way to create this sort of slow progress? And how much of it really seems to be an aberration that's occurring?
I think that's an important point, which is by design, we are not a country where something that attracts the support of 52% of the people can immediately become government policy. And you can lament that or you can cheer it, but that is a deeply American tradition. I once went to a lunch at the British Embassy where they were doing kind of previewing what their budget was. This was during the global financial crisis, so it felt like every country's budget affected every other. And they started, it was four or five economics reporters in Washington, and they started by saying, just so you know, our budget will actually become law for you Americans who aren't used to that, right? Because they have a parliamentary government, and the majority not only has control of the legislature, parliament, but they also have the prime minister seat. And so it would be as if Nancy Pelosi was the head of state and you could just basically pass whatever you want. We don't have that. Whether you like it or not, it is fundamentally American. The founders designed our government this way. They wanted more decentralized power. They didn't want a strong central government. And that is deeply, deeply American. Checks and balances, difficulty getting things done. Maybe it's no longer working out so well, but I just want to make clear it is American. I think where we've departed from American traditions here is the idea that over a consistent period of time, multiple years, multiple decades even, views that represent the minority will or minority of enfranchised citizens are basically going to be able to dominate the government. And you can't find an earlier period in American history when that happened. It is not the case that, oh yeah, Ronald Reagan won elections and he got to pass what he wanted, but he represented really only what 40% of Americans wanted. Ronald Reagan won landslide victories. And the only reason Republicans didn't control Congress by more was because at the time Congress had a lot of Democrats who were really Republicans from the South, but they still called themselves Democrats. FDR legitimately represented the majority view of most Americans, and that's why they were able to govern. And we just don't have that today. And I think for people, and you often hear this from conservatives, we're a republic, not a democracy, which is, you know, literally true. We are a republic. We elect people to make decisions for us. it is important to go back to the founders' words and read what they said about the idea of majority sentiment. Now, you may not agree with them for defining it in a way that didn't include the majority of the population, people who weren't white, people who weren't male. But to them, this idea of majority will was really important. And I brought a couple of the quotes that I used in the article because I think they're important here. So in the Federalist Papers, James Madison equated, quote, a coalition of a majority of the whole society with justice and the general good. And Alexander Hamilton said representative democracy is happy, regular, and durable. They didn't want, essentially, to have a situation where you had a minority of enfranchised citizens controlling the government. They instead wanted a situation where the majority was empowered, but limited.
So we're living through somewhat of an aberration period. Let's take a break. We're going to come back with David Leonhard, and we're going to talk about how we got there and some of his answers based on his work were surprising to me, and they may be surprising to you as well.
Hi there, it's Julia Louis-Dreyfus. You may know me from my podcast called Wiser Than Me, where I talk to older women and get their wisdom from the front lines of life. After season one aired, I was amazed by how many people told me our show made them look forward to getting older, which is why I'm here to talk about season two of the show. Sally Field, Billie Jean King, Beverly Johnson, Ina Garten, Bonnie Raitt, just to name a few. And of course, my 90-year-old mom, Judy. All hail old women. Wiser Than Me Season 2 is out now from Lemonada Media.
Hi, I'm June Diane Raphael.
And I'm Jessica St. Clair.
And each week we are sitting down to talk all about life's twists, turns, and absurdities on The Deep Dive.
From exploring the depths of TikTok, which is our only news source, to navigating the complexities of grief and loss, we are just two best friends behind a mic processing life together.
This podcast is all about finding the silver linings in the madness. So get ready for unfiltered conversations about motherhood, careers, pop culture, and everything in between.
Here at The Deep Dive, we're all about community. We believe in the power of sharing experiences and the strength that comes from supporting one another. And we would love to have you with us.
So be sure to join us every Wednesday on The Deep Dive from Lemonada Media, wherever you get your podcasts.
So, David, if you ask people, at least in my social circles, to describe why we're in the situation we are with democracy, and I'm leaving Trump to later in the conversation for now, and I'm talking about the issues we've been talking about, they will say things like gerrymandering, voter suppression, the Electoral College. Those will be the things that come to mind. But in your work, you actually pointed to some other fundamental things that are not as nefarious or ill-designed, such as where we live and where we choose to live. Can you talk about that and why that's making a difference now?
Yeah, absolutely. Liberals, to exaggerate, to overgeneralize, liberals are correct that we face a crisis of democracy, but sometimes get the causes of it somewhat wrong. And the causes that are often most cited, like gerrymandering and voter suppression, they are small and could eventually get bigger, but they're really not the main things going on. So you just talked about the idea of where we live being important. We have had this incredible sorting over the last couple of generations in which metropolitan areas have become very progressive and smaller cities and rural areas have become very conservative. It's sort of remarkable. I mean, Democrats now win, I think, something like 49 of the 50 largest metro areas in the country. They win metro areas even in red states. And the flip is also true. I mean, take a look at a map of New York. There's by land, there's a massive amount of red.
Any state you live in, rural Minnesota, rural California.
Exactly.
Very red.
So this is the main reason the House is biased toward Republicans. What ends up happening when you have a situation like that is just almost mathematically, it's really hard to draw fair districts. So you don't have to be a Republican trying to maximize Republican seats to struggle to draw districts that are fair to Democrats. If you just think about drawing districts, if tons of Democrats are packed in to, you know, a couple of small towns west of Boston or Central City, Philadelphia, or places like that, they basically are wasting votes. You're going to have whoever represents those places winning by landslides. And if that logic doesn't persuade you, I would encourage you, go look at the list of House members who won their most recent election by more than 50 percentage points. So that's at least 75-25 or more. Mm. We included a map with my story. There are a whole bunch of them in California, in New York, in Illinois, in Colorado. And what do those states have in common? Republicans don't control the districting process in those states. They, by definition, cannot be the result of evil genius Republican gerrymandering. Democrats drew those lines. And yet, across the country, there are just many more Democratic landslides than Republican landslides.
Because you got to find, what, like 800,000 people or so?
Yeah, a little less.
Roughly speaking, yeah, for each district. And so you're saying, whatever your intent is, if you have all of the Democrats living close together in a very small geographic area, and they don't live in outlying suburbs or exurbs or rural areas, then you're going to have to draw a lot of large Republican districts that just don't happen to have a lot of Democrats.
That's right. So imagine a 50-50 state. If you have a whole bunch of districts that are 95-5 Democrats, by definition, the rest of the state is going to tilt slightly Republican, right?
And that's the House. And then in the Senate, you've got a lot of states that have that are just largely rural. And so the equal representation that each state gets seems to create that bias. So both of these things hinge on something that I think, I'm not sure if it's always been the case, which is that people in rural America seem to identify and want things that are different than people in urban areas. In other words, if we lived at a time, and maybe you could take us back, where people in Montana and West Virginia, many of whom were Democrats, and Democrats are spread into rural areas, then you wouldn't have this sort of effect that seems to be changing the way the democracy works quite the same way. Is that right?
That's right. Now, it's always been the case that there's, I mean, in most societies for most of history, modern history, there's been a rural-urban political divide, and that rural areas have been more conservative than urban areas. That is an enduring feature of modern societies. You can, you know, just think of all the, you know, big city snobs and, right, and Republicans make fun of, well, I mean, what's that? There's some famous ad from years ago, you know, NPR listening, Starbucks drinking, New York Times reading, you know, whatever, Volvo driving. And the flip side is Karl Marx talked about the idiocy of rural life, or maybe it was Engels, but one of them did. And so there's always been this divide. What has changed is that didn't used to be a partisan divide. Mm. So, and it wasn't a partisan divide because you had a lot of conservative Democrats in rural areas, conservative people in rural areas who consider themselves Democrats, party of the working class. And then you had sort of liberal Republicans living in big cities, Rockefeller Republicans, George Romney Republicans, things like that. And what's happened is that this, not only have we kind of sorted even more than in the past, but this sorting has become much, much more partisan. So in today, ask someone one question about politics, and you can often accurately guess their opinion on nearly everything. And so this, the combination of this sorting, the fact that it has happened on partisan lines, and then you add in, I mean, the Senate really is the most important thing in here. You add in the massive bias that the Senate gives to less populated areas. The House gives a small bias. The Senate gives a massive one. And you have the situation.
So have people changed or have the parties changed?
That's a good question. I guess this is sort of a cop-out, but I think people have changed the parties. I mean, there was this whole kind of debate in political science in the 50s and 60s lamenting that the parties were inchoate and it was hard to tell the difference between what was a Democrat and what was a Republican because you had liberals, Republicans, and conservative Democrats. And we solved that problem, right? But it looks like we created a bigger problem along the way. And so it really sort of has changed our parties in the process, and then it feeds on itself, right? I mean, you used to have much more tolerance for ideological diversity in parties than you do today. I mean, it's just, you don't really have, you can't really win election as a Republican if you are pro-choice, and you can't really win election as a Democrat if you're pro-life, and that's new.
So now let's enter an individual, Donald Trump.
Yep.
How does he fit into this equation that we just laid out?
He's a very important figure here, although it does not all spring from Donald Trump. And I think one of the things that I think journalism sometimes struggles with, and probably just human beings, is we know how to describe situations that are like 100% one way or 100% the other way, and we know how to describe situations that are 50-50. But like 80-20 is kind of hard, and that's something I think a lot about. And this is one of those. It doesn't all spring from Donald Trump, but Donald Trump is also an important cause of what's going on. And so for whatever combination of reasons, and I would cite the Republican Party has basically become more radical in a bunch of these ways. That predates Donald Trump. You can see it in a whole bunch of different ways. The increasing use of the filibuster. A bunch of these voting restrictions and gerrymandering stuff, they predate Donald Trump. Mitch McConnell saying, I want to make Barack Obama a failed president. That predates Donald Trump. So it's not just about Trump. I think the Republican Party has become more radicalized for a mix of reasons. I think the fact that you see this around the affluent world, working class living standards have stagnated and the working class has moved to the right. Clearly, racism and racial fears play a role. Clearly, fears about the U.S. becoming more secular play a role. There are a whole bunch of things going on here. But then Trump comes on the scene and basically starts smashing norms left and right, much further than the party had gone before.
So there are a couple things you mentioned here, one of which is simply more overtly appealing to a sizable minority. We shouldn't forget the fact that, you know, we're talking about, I think, according to the latest New York Times poll, I saw 45% of Americans, according to this Siena New York Times poll, view Donald Trump favorably. So I would invite you to comment on that, because I think you can live in bubbles where that seems impossible to believe, yet this is what the polling says. But there is a strategy, and I don't know if it was overt or he happened on it, to say we can win by really appealing to this minority sector, given all of the other rules that govern the majority and minority here, and win. And this is 2016. This is before the big lie. So there was already a candidate who could demonstrate that he had more effectively pulled together the forces in this kind of, increasingly minority, rural, white part of the country and win an election with the Electoral College. That's before you get to 2020.
Right.
That he seemingly said, I'm going to shatter the norms even further by suggesting that if I want to be in power, I can begin to assert my ability to get there. And then the cut ahead to 2024, which is to say, can you in fact have enough people in the country who control the way voting works that he can actually pull that off?
Yeah, it's deeply scary. And I mean, we can never rerun history. There's a chance that he didn't become that more radical between 2016 and 2020. The difference is he won in 2016. He won the Electoral College, so he didn't have to lie and cheat. And in 2020, he lost, so he did. And as you've said, the great fear now is that you've got somewhere between a third and a half of Republican nominees for statewide offices in this election cycle. And now not every state is holding elections this year, but a lot are. A third to a half, according to 538, are election deniers, depending how you define an election denier.
And you're a third and a half of people running for statewide office.
Running for statewide office, attorney general, governor, secretary of state, offices like that. So if you just do the like outright lie about what happened in 2020, I think it's more like 40%. And if you include the people who kind of do wink and a nod, won't say Biden won, but don't go as far as Trump, it's closer to 50%. And so it's a really alarmingly high share. And it obviously raises the possibility that what Trump tried to do in Georgia and failed because Republican officials rebuffed him, next time there might be a state or two or three where they don't rebuff him.
Let's take another quick break, and we'll come back with David to talk about what all this means and how it's likely to play out.
People love to pretend that there are simple formulas for living your best life now. Eat this and you won't get sick. Manifest it and everything will work out. But there are some things you can choose and some things you can't. And it's okay that life isn't always getting better. I'm Kate Bowler, and on Everything Happens, I speak with kind, smart, funny people about life as it really is. Beautiful, terrible, and everything in between. Let's be human together. Everything Happens is available wherever you get your podcasts.
Can't get enough of your favorite Lemonada Media podcasts? By subscribing to Lemonada Premium today, you'll gain access to fun and inspiring bonus content from all of our podcasts across the Lemonada Media Network. As a subscriber, you can listen to never-before-heard interview excerpts between Julia Louis-Dreyfus and her A-plus guests on Wiser Than Me, laugh along with Elise Myers as she and her guests play a rapid-fire questions game on Funny 'Cause It's True, and continue to uncover new ways to make life suck less through our exclusive subscriber audio. Check out a free trial of Lemonada Premium today in the Apple Podcast app by clicking on our podcast logo and then the subscribe button.
So I hear you, David, that a third to a half of Republicans running in 2022 in November for statewide office are election deniers. It would seem to me that that couldn't be possible if that also wasn't reflecting of their constituents' views.
Yes, although it's important to know that constituents' views, that's a two-way street. Leadership can shape constituents' views. And I think that's one of the most important effects that Donald Trump had, which is I don't think people just naturally came to this view. And I think actually some number of these people don't even really believe it, although it doesn't matter so much whether they honestly believe it. If they use it to overturn an election, it doesn't matter whether you really believed you won or lost.
Well, I look at it this way. I don't know that people are really thinking about the question. I think we just decide what our tribe is.
Yes.
Yes. If I'm Catholic or I'm Protestant, then I may think, you know, do I believe everything that the Protestant faith tells me? It doesn't matter. I'm Protestant. And so if the Protestants say X,
yeah,
that's kind of the camp I'm in. I'm not certainly going to take over one issue and leave the Protestant denomination because I don't agree with one issue. And so it feels like almost the question of why do people believe something that's provably false is it may not even be a question that's being asked in those circles that explicitly.
Right. I really do think there's a feedback loop. I mean, we see this again and again in politics. You know, when you had Barack Obama change his position on same-sex marriage and come out in favor of it, you immediately saw a discontinuity in which you saw more support for it among Democratic-leaning groups. So this is not a phenomenon only among conservatives. It's also among Democrats and liberals in which political leaders, leadership matters. Political leaders can mold opinion as well as reflect it. But wherever the cause is and wherever the chicken and the egg is, we're at the point where you're right, that this is reflective of the views of a lot of people.
So, you know, according to the New York Times Siena poll, 45% of Americans view Trump favorably. And what's interesting about that is that it hasn't really changed much right. Over a lot of new information coming out about Trump.
Although, as someone who grew up in New York City in the 80s, I would say maybe it's not even that much new information. Maybe it's new versions of what we've always known about Donald Trump. But yes, your point is more important than mine.
Well, it's a dialing up. It's a dialing up. But certainly, like, you know, like I had Anthony Scaramucci on this show in 2020, and he talked about how he fell out of love with Trump. And I just said, look, Anthony, I have to ask you, this isn't a gotcha question, but I just have to ask you, what part of Barack Obama wasn't born in America, did you not hear?
Right.
So it's been there from the beginning.
From the beginning.
From the beginning. It says something. that 45% of Americans view favorably, despite, and maybe even at this point, the evidence of what's coming out helps dig them in deeper to their view. And I think we all know what it's like to support someone who is embattled. And I would remind Democrats, including myself, who supported Bill Clinton in the 90s after the Monica Lewinsky situation, that it is pretty easy to make excuses. But I think to the question of the democracy, how much of what is of imminent threat is dependent on Trump versus, do you think, where the Republican Party has now been trained well enough by Trump that even without him, this is the space that they're going to inhabit? In other words, if Trump did not run in 2024 or lost and someone else ran in 2028, would we be in similar situations? Or is this like, you know, you got a Le Pen or a Mussolini or a Bolsonaro who's effectively can galvanize this, but if that person's not in the picture, you feel quite a bit differently about the prospects of democracy?
That is, in some ways, it is one of the biggest unknowns. It's one of the biggest and most important unknowns. I don't think there's any question that if Trump runs again and loses, he'll try to overturn the election using lies. I feel very confident about. I don't think we know whether he would succeed. I don't think we know whether we'd get a different outcome than we had in Georgia in 2024. And to your question, I don't think we know if there were another Republican nominee, say Ron DeSantis, who seems like the most likely non-Trump nominee, whether he would do it as well. On the one hand, no one has ever behaved like Trump. DeSantis has not done a bunch. He has not repeated Trump's election lies the way Trump has. He just hasn't. On the other hand, DeSantis has been very happy to endorse and campaign for people who have. DeSantis seems clearly comfortable with the idea of not telling the truth, if you read some of the profiles of him and his press strategy. And so I think we don't know. Can I say one thing about how I think Democrats can minimize the odds of a bad outcome here? And this is a tough subject because Democrats didn't create this problem. So let me repeat that. Democrats didn't create this problem. Republicans created this problem. Democrats are not the ones who are lying about elections. They're not the ones threatening to overturn elections. Democrats are basically accepting of election results when they lose. But that, you know, that's small comfort if we lose our democracy. And so I think one of the things that if you're either a Republican who's horrified by this, or an independent who's horrified by it, or a Democrat, and almost all Democrats are, the question to ask now is, how do we minimize the odds that something like this happens? And I think one important thing for Democrats to think a little bit about is, how do we win over the winnable people? And I think it, by definition, a lot of the people who are winnable, who are important here, are Republicans. Democrats are won over to the idea that Donald Trump is a liar and a cheater and is trying to steal the election and all of that. And so I would argue that Democrats have a bunch of sort of argumentative instincts that are counterproductive. So saying that all Donald Trump supporters are fundamentally racist is counterproductive. First of all, I think it's analytically wrong. I think many of his supporters are racist. But, you know, Donald Trump increased his support among Latino voters in 2020 significantly. So this isn't just about race. Second of all, there are a whole bunch of conservative positions that Republicans are using the mechanisms of our government, these anti-democratic mechanisms, to push, but they are not inherently undemocratic. It is not undemocratic to believe that we should admit fewer immigrants. It is not undemocratic to believe that people should be allowed to use guns with relatively few restrictions. It's not undemocratic to be against access to abortion. Those are conservative views. You can think they're wrong. You can think they're dangerous. You can think they end up killing people, but they're not undemocratic. And huge numbers of Americans, including a lot of people who identify as moderates, including a lot of people who are not white, hold some of those opinions. And to be clear, this is not the original problem. But if Democrats want to persuade people and try to keep our democracy, I think it's important not to ask persuadable Republicans to sign up for every item of the Democratic agenda and to paint anybody who doesn't as some combination of uneducated and bigoted.
Yeah, a good example of this would be a lot of the hate that like a Susan Collins might receive because she holds liberal views on some issues, but not every issue. And the fact that, you know, you can get 10, 12, 15 votes in the Senate from some Republicans on some issues is something that you could get an occasional yes, which is better than 100% no's. And that's actually a sign that people are actually communicating and finding common ground, and that people could have ideological sensibilities that could be different, but find common space. It brings me to kind of a way that I want to start to begin to close the conversation, which is a couple premises that have sort of been established here. One is that we're pretty divided as a country, and we're divided in terms of where we live geographically.
Yes.
And that among other things, means that people who hold minority views are been overrepresented right now in our democracy and the way that works. And that's not just necessarily a Trump thing, but that if we want to work on our democracy, there are broader things to do. And I want to go down a couple lanes. I want to go down two lanes with you. The second lane I want to go down is maybe the more interesting one, which is the policy lane. Like, what are some of the things we could be doing? The first lane I want to go down is one of civility in discourse.
Yeah.
Because I think you kind of hinted at it. And also, David, you got somewhat dragged into this related to COVID that I wonder if it's interesting to reflect on.
Yeah.
You, I think, attracted flack, I think probably because people who found themselves agreeing with you on many, many things saw you writing things that they disagreed with. And so I want to have this conversation because in the bubble, I'll just say one of our values would be like, disagreement is fine.
Yes, it's good.
Civil disagreement expands how we think about things, expands our knowledge. It's part of the process. And in my mind, it doesn't make you a bad person. Now, I think Trump is a bad person, but I think that for a lot of reasons besides his political views, there's people who could share his views. And I still feel like our job, and I've served in the government, is to figure out how to get in the room with people who are of goodwill and good intention, who are serious about solving a problem no matter where they come from. And I had to do that. It's part of my job, both in the Obama administration and in the Biden administration. And by the way, even if you don't like it, it's a fact of life because that's just the way things are. But something got triggered which made the person you disagree with sort of an enemy and a bad person by default. I don't know if you want to reflect on how you felt it happening to you or not. That's not really my point. But how much of that situation, the inability to have this sort of civil society, an exchange of views, have we lost? And how much of a part of the equation is that?
I do think we're losing parts of it. I think it's not one of these binary things. I would guess you agree with this. It's not that we have it or we've lost it. It sort of exists on a spectrum. And I do really worry about that. I think that, look, by definition, I understand that one of the reasons why people get so worked up about these debates is that they're high-stakes debates. I mean, you spend a lot of time working on getting people health insurance, for example. That's a high-stakes debate. Right. So, for example, someone who was against the idea of expanding Obamacare, if you believe in expanding health insurance and you've read the research, someone who is against the idea of an expansion of government health insurance, you could, from a logical perspective, very plausibly argue that they were in favor of having people die needlessly. Mm-hmm. Right. Yep. My guess is if you kind of like went from one A to B to C to D to E to F, like you might even believe that, right?
Sure.
And just let's expand that, like Israel and Palestine, whether we should go to war in Iraq and Afghanistan. I mean, these are life and death issues. But if we turn every one of those debates into basically trying to silence the people with whom we disagree, we lose something really important as a country. And if you say, well, the only reason you're against that is because you're selfish or because you're bigoted, and you basically turn everything into, this is because I have wisdom and I have enlightenment and you're a bad person, society, A, sort of breaks down, and B, just from a tactical perspective, you're not going to win over the persuadable people.
Be careful about adding motive to people's actions until you really understand them. Let's close by talking about some policy things. I'd love a quick reaction to these things and how they might help or fix democracy. Ranked choice voting.
I like ranked choice voting, and I think it has the potential to help less extreme candidates. The easiest way to see it is if we had ranked choice voting in the 2016 Republican primaries, Donald Trump would have lost. But I also take seriously the idea that it's more complicated and it's not going to solve our biggest problems. So I prefer it, but I would put the magnitude of its benefit as modest.
The Electoral College reform bills being debated in the Senate right now.
More important. You would need a set of states representing a majority of Electoral College votes to basically create a compact where they would always award their Electoral College votes to the winner of the popular vote. So then by definition, the winner of the popular vote would win. That would be a big deal and would be an important change.
How about the ending the filibuster?
Also important. Look, there would be downsides. Most liberals are the ones in favor of getting rid of it. Liberals need to kind of grapple with the fact there would be downsides. That when you have a Republican president and between 50 and 59 Republican senators, Republicans could do a lot more, you know, including stuff that Democrats really might not like restrict abortion. Having said that, I think we have enough checks and balances in our society. And so whether it should go away completely, I think moving in the direction of less filibuster is more small D democratic. And I also just think empirically over our history as a country, the filibuster has overwhelmingly been a tool of the status quo. It denied rights to Black Americans. It tends to be against things that would reduce economic inequality. Really, if you're on the left half of the political spectrum, getting rid of the filibuster would on net help you more than it would hurt you.
Voting right reforms.
I think that depends there. You alluded to this before. I know there's a lot of focus on the idea of these voting restrictions. A whole bunch of them have passed. I don't really see the argument, a logical argument in a democracy where we don't have any meaningful voter fraud for why we need to make it harder for people to vote. And some of these laws do that. But having said that, you know, presidential turnout was the highest in at least a century in 2020. They don't seem to be having a big effect yet. I do think they might eventually have an effect, but that's another example, along with gerrymandering, of that's not as big of a problem right now as some people claim.
Anything I didn't mention, any reforms you think ought to be seriously on the table?
Yes. I think there are a whole bunch of structural reforms that are going to sound radical to people, but that are actually consistent with American history. We're now in our longest stretch without admitting a new state. Washington, D.C. Is bigger than Wyoming. It has huge numbers of African Americans living there. How is it that that is not a state? Puerto Rico is bigger than about 20 states. And so the idea of if Washington, D.C. and Puerto Rico were admitted, it would reduce, not eliminate, reduce the Senate's bias against people of color and reduce the Senate's bias against metropolitan areas. And then there's also kind of a history of Congress and the president not treating the Supreme Court as if it is above the two of them. The Constitution didn't design the Supreme Court as the most powerful branch. It can check Congress and the president, co-equal. Congress and the president can go back and do things like pass laws that are more specific and that go around a Supreme Court ruling. They can do things like the Constitution specifically allows Congress to restrict what areas the Supreme Court can review. Congress, and I'm not advocating this, can change the size of the Supreme Court. Those are all things that have happened in history. And we've weirdly ended up in this time, whether it's the size of the House, which used to grow over time, whether it's the number of states, which used to grow over time, whether it's how Congress and the president treat the Supreme Court, in which we're in this ahistorical period of stasis. Mm. And that's not how a democracy should work.
Well, maybe those are good thoughts for the next time we get out of gridlock to be able to basically make democratic reforms important. I have a friend who serves in Congress who has a saying who says, no matter what your number one important issue is, your number two issue should be democracy reform, because that's how you'll make sure that your issue and all the others get honored. David, thank you so much for this invigorating conversation. There was certainly a lot more we could get to. I think we're going to have to watch what happens closely in 2022 and mostly in the lead up. Really, I think the most important part of 2022, and you said it, is maybe not the House and the Senate. It's these state races that will be the lead up to how votes are counted in 2024. Wish us luck and Godspeed.
Thanks so much, Andy. This was great.
Let me tell you what's coming up on Wednesday. We have Neel Kashkari from the Federal Reserve here. We're going to talk about the interest rate hikes, what this is doing to inflation, what this is doing to the economy, how the Fed is intending to manage this process. It is a pretty rare thing to get someone from the Fed to make public comments in light of a very delicate situation. So we're pleased to have that conversation. That'll be on Wednesday. Friday conversation, as always. Look forward to a great week. I hope it is a spectacular one for you, whatever you're doing. Thanks for listening. Thank you for listening to In the Bubble. We're a production of Lemonada Media. Catherine Barnes, Jackie Harris, and Cal Sheely produce our show, and they're great. Our mix is by Noah Smith and James Barber, and they're great too. Steve Nelson is the Vice President of Weekly Content, and he's okay too. And of course, the ultimate bosses, Jessica Cordova Kramer and Stephanie Whittleswax, the executive produce the show, and we love them dearly. Our theme was composed by Dan Malad and Oliver Hill, with additional music by Ivan Kuriev. You can find out more about our show on social media at Lemonada Media, where you can also get a transcript of the show, and you can find me at Ace Lavitt on Twitter. If you like what you heard today, why don't you tell your friends to listen as well and get them to write a review. Thanks so much. Talk to you next time.
Do you ever get hit with a cringy memory of your 13-year-old self out of nowhere, and suddenly you're panic sweating and laughing at the same time? Don't worry. We all get that. It's because being an adolescent is one of the most visceral shared experiences we have as people. And we want to talk about it. Join me, Penn Badgley, and my two friends, Nava and Sophie, on Podcrushed as we interview celebrity guests about the joys and horrors of being a teenager and how those moments made them who they are today. New episodes of Podcrushed are out on April 24th, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Elise Myers. I'm a content creator and comedian. You might know me from TikTok. Why am I in your ears right now? Well, that's a great question. I would love to tell you. I have a new podcast called Funny Because It's True. On my show, I'll be interviewing comedians, pop culture icons, and also just people I find really funny. We'll be talking about the awkward moments that keep you awake at night. Because if you don't laugh, you cry, right? Okay, Funny Because It's True. Out now wherever you get your podcasts.